This podcast is brought to you by the Ethical Society of St. Louis, acting to bring out the best in others and thereby in ourselves. The following recording is of a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady, leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis. Entitled, Communicating Across the Aisle, it was recorded live on 9 November 2008.
I'm going to start this morning with attempting to say good morning in Swahili. Ed, if you're out there, you'll know if I'm doing this wrong. Let's see if you can follow me. I'm going to do this in two parts. Habari ya asubuhi. Habari ya asubuhi. Well done. Good morning. So on the afternoon of Election Day, I was coming home from jury duty across Forest Park. This was my day to stand online for democracy. And as I was coming home, I stopped in at the art museum, and I stood for a long time looking at a set of paintings that I had never really studied before. They are three crowd scenes by George Caleb Bingham. They depict a Missouri county campaign and election in the 1850s. And the scenes have this party atmosphere, and they depict the rich and the poor and even the dead drunk who are being taken to vote. Everyone in the paintings is male, and everyone is white, except in the painting in which the winner of the election is being announced, where way up in the background, in the balcony, barely visible, are few white women. And in the shadow in the foreground is a black man pushing a wheelbarrow, presumably, I assume, a slave. And I wondered if these scenes were painted from life. And I wished that all those people, but especially the women way up on the balcony and the man pushing the wheelbarrow, could somehow know about this year's election. And so I stood there talking to them for a little while. And I was not thrown out of the museum, which I appreciated. The greatness of this moment in history is undeniable, no matter what your party affiliation may be. And yet there's also a lot of healing to do now after a campaign in which large percentages of people on both sides said that they were afraid of what would happen if the other side won. So many people worked so hard, and yet only one candidate can win any position. So how can we now unite as a country after such a divisive period? There has been far too much demonizing on both sides, far too much labeling of people instead of discussion of ideas. The problems that the country is now facing, we know, are large and serious, and we need everyone working on them together. So this morning, I want to get away from rhetoric and instead talk a little bit about how people make moral decisions in the hope that through understanding people better, even if we disagree, we can still recognize everyone as an ethical being and work more effectively with everyone, I hope, on our common problems. I was recently introduced to the work of psychology researcher Jonathan Haidt, and he theorizes that when people are deciding whether an action is moral or immoral, we judge those actions based on these five categories of universal human values. So these universal human values, the first one is harm and care. So we ask ourselves, does this action help or hurt individuals? The second value is called fairness or reciprocity. And that's when we ask ourselves, well, does this action treat individuals equally or does it treat them unequally? The third he calls in-group loyalty. And that's when we ask, does this action harm the group? The fourth is authority and respect, and we ask, does this action undermine established authority, or does it support established authority? And the fifth he calls purity sanctity. And this is a little fuzzier. It's sort of related to a sense of disgust that we may have. I think it usually boils down to the question of, does this action support or undermine self-control and what we consider traditionally virtuous behavior? So another word for that fifth one may be temperance. And I'm guessing that as you heard me reading those five moral values and those five questions to decide whether something is moral or immoral, some of those questions probably seemed more relevant to you, more important to you than others. Haidt is interested in how people who consider themselves liberal and people who consider themselves conservative differ in how they decide on the morality of a proposed action. And his research on these values suggests that conservatives tend to weigh all of these five categories about equally, whereas liberals tend to heavily emphasize the first two. That is, liberals feel that an action is moral or immoral based mostly on whether they think it will help or harm individuals and whether they think it treats individuals fairly. Conservatives feel that an action is moral or immoral based in part on whether they think it will help or harm individuals and whether or not it's fair, but also on whether they think the action will help or harm a group, help or harm established authority, and help or harm what they consider virtuous self-control. So if Haidt's theory is correct, then the primary moral concern of liberals is to affirm and defend the rights of individuals, whereas the primary moral concern of conservatives is to balance individual rights with traditional group power, hierarchy, and beliefs. Now, if we look at Haidt's five moral values, we can see that the more conservative values of defending group power and hierarchy and beliefs clearly have a long adaptive history in human development. Such values helped societies and their members to survive. They provided them with safety, stability, predictability, peace of mind. But the more liberal values of avoiding harm to others and seeking fairness are also ancient social values. Many social animals even, they demonstrate empathy, they demonstrate a sense of reciprocity. Yet really only in the last few hundred years did some people begin to assert that individual rights might actually trump what they saw as mere social conventions. So liberalism is really very new in human evolution. It wasn't even possible to think about living as an individual for most of human history. If you bucked the group or if you rejected authority and tried to live autonomously, you were very likely to starve or to die of disease or an accident or to become some other group's slave or some other animal's dinner. If you rejected purity conventions, you might eat something poisonous or again be rejected by the community. So my point this morning isn't to talk about which is better or worse, but to talk about them both as being reasonable ways of looking at the world based in a long history of humanity, and how do we deal with these different ways of looking at the world. Now, if we want to test Haidt's theory, we can look at the Ethical Society's statement of purpose. And what we will find reflected there are the values of individual rights, of harm versus care, and of fairness, that is, of those first two so-called liberal rights. Our statement of purpose says that we are a community of people. We can't even just say community. We have to say community of people because we are individuals, dedicated to deed before creed, emphasizing that we're not bound by traditional institutions or authorities or beliefs. Our affirmations to bring out the best, to appreciate the uniqueness and worth, to treat all with dignity and respect. Again, these reflect values of individual care and fairness. We have an affirmation to cultivate a a community of people who support each other through the stages of life. But it's interesting that that also emphasizes individual care. And the word cultivate implies that community should be voluntary. We should choose to support each other rather than doing so out of duty or tradition, which seems more friendly, probably to us, but also begs the question, or brings up the question, I should say, what happens when the needs of the community conflict with the needs of the individual? I'd argue that the only non-individualist part of our statement of purpose is our affirmation to act with reverence and commitment toward the natural world. And it's interesting that Haight says that environmentalism is the closest that liberals come to the traditional value of temperance or purity. So we don't have rules about what food you should eat or whether or not you should drink alcohol or many rules about sex beyond don't hurt yourself and respect others. But it's pretty clear that a Prius and fair trade coffee is more ethically kosher than, say, driving a Hummer and drinking a Coke. So we have our own purity rules. So I'm not going to go through every word, but trust me that there's very little you can find in our statement of purpose that affirms the values of group loyalty or respect for tradition or authority. If anything, we're anti-authoritarian. We're non-theistic. We affirm no holy person, no holy scripture, no holy object. We do have sacred cows, so to speak, but I usually only find out about them after I have accidentally tipped them. I was listening again, as I always do, to our Sunday school core values, and I'm fascinated by the one that says, I can learn from the past to build for the future. Because a somewhat conservative value of tradition and past, but I can learn. It is optional for me to learn from the past because respect for tradition is conditional. Tradition has to earn its respect. And that value is followed by I am free to question and I am free to choose what I believe, which places the individual's right of conscience above all, even for our smallest children. So this may be very shocking to you, but I believe this is a liberal institution. But just because ethical culture is a liberal religion, we shouldn't assume that we're all the same here. Liberal to conservative is a continuum. And although, unlike Congress, I hope that we don't choose which side of the aisle to sit on here based on political leanings, we need to remember that each of us may weigh competing values a little differently from each other, and differently depending on each issue. And so the type of understanding and communication that I'm advocating applies when you're talking to the person sitting next to you, as well as when you're talking to somebody on the opposite side of an issue. I have often heard liberals accuse conservatives of lacking empathy. And that seems unlikely, and it seems unfair. Haight is a liberal himself, and he hopes that what his theory will do is help liberals understand conservatives better by showing that conservatives do have empathy for individuals. They just disagree with liberals that concern for individual rights should always outweigh concern for social institutions and authority and traditional beliefs. So, again, we don't have to agree, but instead of simply dismissing conservatives as heartless, liberals can respect conservatives' values while still trying to persuade. Stories of individuals have great power, from Uncle Tom's Cabin, even to silly sitcoms like Will and Grace, because they can lead to greater acceptance of so-called liberal values by boosting empathy for people who are being harmed by social traditions, which may be why Hollywood is supposed to be such an evil place, which otherwise I've never really understood. More important than stories, even knowing real individuals that are different from you can also boost empathy so that it overcomes traditional concerns. There's a remarkable video that I finally saw of last year, San Diego's conservative mayor reversed his opposition to same-sex marriage because his daughter and several staff members are gay or lesbian. And as he said in this press conference, while literally choking back tears, he could not face people that he loved and tell them that their relationships were not equal to his own. So what's important to remember is that everyone, liberal, conservative, and the vast space in between, everyone has all of these five values in common. Liberals may emphasize individual rights, but if they also care about stable institutions and authority and traditional beliefs, and they can learn to speak from all five values if they want to reassure conservatives that expanding individual rights will not destroy what's good in traditional society. And both sides, everybody worries about unchecked materialism, and everyone desires positive, nurturing relationships. So one way liberals can find common ground with conservatives is to widen the discussion beyond the two values of harm and fairness. The environmental movement has grown as conservative environmentalists have begun speaking to their members using the other three values, respect for authority and purity. They say that messing up God's earth is an insult to God, that taking care of the earth is our responsibility as those whom God put in charge as stewards of the earth. The environment is a pure creation of God and should not be despoiled. Now, these arguments may or may not make sense to you, but allowing space for them in the conversation about the environment is creating powerful coalitions of conservative and liberal environmentalists, and we need coalitions in order to really achieve change in this society. So how else can we communicate better, especially with those with whom we disagree? Haidt's research is based on the hope that if we can learn to hear the underlying values, hopes, and fears beneath words, words that otherwise might not make sense to us or that might even be offensive to us, then we can begin to address those hopes and fears, and that we may even find a compromise that moves the discussion forward. And I'm grateful to Howard for talking about the gift of listening, because listening is so important to this. If we make positive rather than negative assumptions about others' motives, again, without necessarily agreeing, but simply remembering that we share all five basic moral values, and recognizing that everyone is trying to pursue safety and security, then we can at least be motivated to converse, and we can start from a place of hope and a place of common humanity. Finally, we pride ourselves on our rationality, I think, yet it turns out that we make up our minds even before we're aware of it. I think I've mentioned that brain scans show that when we think we're reasoning something through or actually rationalizing a decision that we've already made unconsciously, based on emotion and memory and biases. So it's crucial that we learn to become aware of our emotions and our thoughts, those instant reactions that we have of anger or disgust or fear or betrayal, those labels that we use to separate ourselves from others, labels such as ignorant, uncaring, elitist, unpatriotic. Whether we ever say them out loud or not, we're labeling people. As I said at the beginning of this season, we need to learn when our buttons are being pushed or when we're about to push someone else's buttons. But now I want to change that metaphor, because it's not so much about pushing each other's buttons as pushing each other away. When we don't listen, when we speak in a way that doesn't acknowledge the humanity and the worth of another person, of another group, when we choose to act in a way that does not elicit the best in others and ourselves, we are really saying, go away. I do not want to be in relationship with you. And we may feel that way. But first, if we believe in deed above creed, we don't have to love everyone. We do have to strive to treat everyone respectfully and fairly and even lovingly. Second, we are in relationship with everyone. Those folks whose opinions you can't stand are your neighbors, your friends, your family members, your fellow citizens, your fellow earth inhabitants. We are in relationship whether we like it or not, whether they like it or not. And so when you communicate in a way that pushes away others, that says, I don't want to be in relationship with you, then you're hurting yourself. We are hurting ourselves. Even if we get in that great zinger at the precise moment and feel that adrenaline rush of, yes, I got them, we have hurt ourselves and we have hurt our own values. Drink coffee instead. I really do feel that we need to know our own emotions and our own minds better. We need to have the skills to choose how to interact with others. And it's been suggested that one of the reasons why Barack Obama is our president-elect is that during the campaign, he seemed to be better at controlling his emotions and choosing his responses calmly. And a calm atmosphere makes people feel safe. And when people feel safer, they're more open to new ideas. They're more open to change. And this is true not only in political campaigns, but in one-on-one conversations with your neighbor. And I want to say that I realized that I was very clumsy in the way that I've introduced this mindfulness moment this year that we're experimenting with. And I know that a lot of you hate it. And I feel that my errors have compounded for many the suspicion that I'm sort of gilding the lily, adding stuff to a platform that was just fine the way it was, or that I'm trying to pander to new age woo-woos or something. And I so regret my clumsiness because I really feel strongly that being more aware of our own minds and our own emotions takes practice, and it takes comfort with silence. Real, reflective, purposeful silence in the presence of others. And that's not Buddhism or secret prayer or New Ageism. That's ethical humanism. Because we cannot choose to act ethically when we are reacting out of our impulses and our biases and our emotions. And I know that 60 seconds once a week is not going to turn any of us into some kind of Zen ethical master. But I do believe that every time you exercise a muscle, it gets stronger. And if there's anything that ethical humanism is about, it's that ethics is not a set of right or wrong rules. Ethics is a muscle that we exercise every time we interact with another person, or every time we sit and look at ourselves. Now, I want to speak to those of us who've been gnawing the bone of this election for so long and will now have to find other things to obsess over. That would be me. We kind of have two choices now. We can find something else to obsess over, or we can strive to allow some peace of mind and some hope for the future to dominate our minds for a while. And I am trying to do that. So I'm going to close with a poem on the pulse of morning, which was written and read by Maya Angelou for the inauguration of Bill Clinton, who we can now stop calling our first black president. And as usual, I'll be downstairs in the library after platform if anyone would like to talk. A rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon. The dinosaur who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor, any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today the rock cries out to us clearly, forcefully, come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny, but seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no hiding place down here. You created only a little lower than the angels, have crouched too long in the bruising darkness, have lain too long face down in ignorance, your mouths spilling words armed for slaughter. The rock cries out to us today, you may stand on me, but do not hide your face. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, come, rest here by my side. Each of you, a bordered country, delicate and strangely made, proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege. Your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today I call you to my riverside if you will study war no more. Come, clad in peace, and I will sing the songs the Creator gave to me when I and the tree and the rock were one, before cynicism was a bloody sear across your brow, and when you yet knew, you still knew nothing. The river sang and sings on. There is a true yearning to respond to the singing river and the wise rock. So say the Asian, the Hispanic, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Catholic, the Muslim, the French, the Greek, the Irish, the rabbi, the priest, the sheikh, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher. They hear. They all hear the speaking of the tree. Today, the first and last of every tree speaks to humankind. Come to me here beside the river. Plant yourself beside me here beside the river. Each of you, descendant of some passed-on traveler, has been paid for. You who gave me my first name, you Pawnee, Apache, Seneca, you Cherokee Nation who rested with me, then forced on bloody feet left me to the employment of other seekers, desperate for gain, starving for gold. You, the Turk, the Arab, the Swede, the German, the Scot, you, the Ashanti, the Yoruba, the crew, bought, sold, stolen, arriving on a nightmare, praying for a dream, here, root yourselves beside me. I am that tree planted by the river, which will not be moved. I, the rock, I, the river, I, the tree, I am yours. Your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. But if faced with courage, it need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here, on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out and upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. No less to Midas than the mendicant. No less to you now than the mastodon then. Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes, and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
You have been listening to a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady on 9 November 2008. To discuss this address, please join in our community forum at www.live.ethicalstl.org. To hear other lectures, to learn more about our society, or about the ethical culture movement, please visit our website at www.ethicalstl.org. Until next time, thank you for listening.